Welcome to the Colorado Review podcast, featuring prose and poetry from both recent and archived issues of the journal. Once a month, we take a look at new content from the Center for Literary Publishing and invite authors to read and discuss their work. My name is Kylan Rice, joined today for a special episode by Mike Lala, whose new book, Exit Theater, is winner of the Colorado Prize for Poetry and debuts this fall. Mike Lala, thanks for joining me today. It's a pleasure to be talking with you.
Thank you for having me.
So we've got this wonderful book from the Center for Literary Publishing, winner of the Colorado Prize for Poetry this year. It's called Exit Theater. And I'm curious, maybe if you could talk generally before we begin sort of diving into it, about the process of getting it from, I don't know, out of your head and into a physical format.
Okay. Yeah. Well, it's, you know, Exit Theater is my first book. So in sort of a weird way, I think with a lot of first books or, you know, first albums or something like that, like it's kind of like, a greatest hits of like early work, in that, like, it's kind of just the poems over the last like 4 or 5 years that I've written that I still feel like are successful. As I kind of collated more and more of those, it became kind of clear that there were like certain topics that bound those poems together. And so at a certain point, maybe when I had like 2/3 of, you know, at least some form of all the texts in the book, then it became like a process of writing new poems or new texts to fill in, you know, the gaps in what I thought would be a book. So, you know, but some of these poems I wrote in like 2011, maybe even 2010. And I finished them maybe in like early 2015 and revised some more after that. But it's like 4 years of work, basically.
Wow. Now, you said that this is perhaps characteristic of first books. Do you have a sense of how you might proceed differently for future books?
Yeah, well, funnily enough, today and over like the last like 2 or 3 weeks, but today I like put some, I won't say like final edits, but like I put together and sort of integrated final edits into like a beta version of a new book, that I kind of want to like send around to some friends and kind of get feedback on. And that process was totally different because it was just, I mean, in some ways it's similar because, you know, here are some poems that I've written and then they all fit together in a certain way and they have like, you know, topical coherence in some way. So the poems that don't deal with those topics don't go in this book and these poems do. But it wasn't really something where I don't know. I think I had a much clearer sense earlier on working on like a second book, what it was going to be versus, you know, for several years, maybe 3 years, just writing poems. And then all of a sudden, oh, this is what this book can be. Right. And I'm going to finish it now.
Right. Coming from the perspective of someone who's also involved with writing and, you know, putting together manuscripts and that sort of thing, you know, I sometimes feel that there's a kind of divide between camps, you know, the camp of people who says, you know, a book doesn't necessarily need a cohering factor. It doesn't need to be, a book of poems doesn't need to be thought of as necessarily, you know, sort of like it doesn't need a necessary trajectory or narrative or anything like that. And then there's another camp who says, well, yes, the book of poems must be a project of poems. You know, it must have some sort of development. And I'm just curious if you have any stake in this conversation Or maybe I'm misrepresenting the conversation, sort of oversimplifying it.
No, I agree with you that a lot of people seem to be really tied to like one idea of what a book of poetry should be. But like many things in the poetry world, I don't really have any convictions about what it should be or whatnot. Like, I don't think that there's any correct way for a poem, an individual poem, to work. It just either does or it doesn't for me. Mm-hmm. And it's the same thing with a book. There's a lot of books that I love that are not particularly coherent as far as like the topics or, you know, a singular topic that they deal with that I love. And there are a lot of books that are more project-based that I really love too. Although I think for me, it's as a writer, it's more useful to think of, in a certain way, having like a thematic framework is, it makes it easy for me, or easier to make good work, because mm-hmm. otherwise I'm kind of like sort of wandering in the dark. But in this case, I really wanted to make a book that dealt with a handful of topics that I was really thinking about a lot over the course of the time of writing it. So that was important to me for this book. And I think it probably will continue to be important for me personally as a poet, but I don't really have any expectations for books as a reader.
Well, let's jump into some of these topics and some of these ideas. I gave us some suggestions to you before this conversation of maybe some poems that I was resonating with in particular. And I wonder if you might either treat us to those or some others, and feel free to provide any sort of information you think a listener might, you know, enjoy hearing beforehand.
Okay, yeah. Well, I'll just start with the first one that you suggested. It's called "The Fire That Consumes All Before It," Reverse Ilium, and it's sort of titled and uses a refrain that comes out of a Cy Twombly painting. 22 years after the Cold War, a stone on a glass plate on the second floor of a rotunda deuxième tour, a woman I watch with a woman I love. Like waters that consume all before them, a man lifts a stone, drops it on a plate of glass. Another traces the plane of his sight with his hand, points to the sky. The Korean Peninsula divides. The first man moves a sea east. Like a snake that consumes all before it, the woman revolves around a wall. Like a hawk, the woman circles it. Like a man, she pushes forward. A second man, our third, appears before the wall. He stands with his legs apart, facing it. The wall does nothing. Like a sun, the woman revolves behind it. The war ends. Our first man moves to Paris. In the country of his birth, I bought 2 tennis shoes, a jersey with my initials, matching socks and gym shorts, a backpack with a cartoon mouse speaking poor English into a bubble. I remember the entire stretch of runway lined with surface missiles pointed north, waking before the city, my mouth open. Like a mirror that subsumes all before it, the glass beneath the rock casts the shadow of a rock, breaking glass on the wall behind it. The 7th Fleet runs exercises off the Sea of Japan. On the floor of the lobby, there are 3 sheets of paper. The woman, like a woman, does not touch. In the end, these men and women who live and work in America stand before the wall and bow. The man from Korea is not here. The cellist, I forget to mention, his long black hair, hands on 2 bows and the neck of his cello, dissonance gathering, forgotten history, he does not bow. Like a phrase, a fire, a language, a line, there is a wall that does not bow. A pig before us, it consumes. A bank, what's behind it, has vanished. A second woman leaps headlong into the arms of a man. He drops her, a wall falls. Now, All but the woman, like ashes, lie down on the paper and rise. Like a fire, there is a wall that stands behind them. Okay, so this next one is a piece from a longer, like, 12-section series called Portraits of the Artists as Their Own Subjects. Most of these are about, like, friends of mine. There's a couple people who I don't know, but, well, you'll see. So this is number four in this section. She moves from the curtain, black dress, bare arms, the man in the pinstriped sleeves, her lover, the man with the chair moves, the man with no shoes, who makes her be held to be in his arms, who makes him to hold her all arms, till he can't and he drops her and she turns, to repeat the holding and repeat being taken and repeat the falling and the turn. As the man in the pinstripe sleeves stands still in the sound of their breathing, water on stone, the woman, black dress, bare arms flailing, not knowing should they hold or what. And this is a couple later in the same series. For him, the trash collected dew. He went out at night and turned it. Brought him home to work in the dark room at the dining table. In the basement, two images overlapping in the color couplers. On the table, two structures working themselves out. His elbows, two cities, arms vertical, wrists bent, turning to meet, trying this height. That. So the next piece I'm going to read is from a really long poem that was initially like a chapbook called In the Gun Cabinet. This is sort of near the beginning when the speaker or I of the poem is sort of has walked into this like imaginary space theater gun cabinet place and exited, and then some other things have happened and now they're back in it. Nocturne in the gun cabinet. My mother's body in wake. Snow falls around me in the hallways of the armory. A bloodhound tracks a dying scent. The snow, white static opalescence, sops a half-beaten hair as I step forward. A chandelier fades. Night, two doors I walk into. Night blooming, dear God, Robert, dear mother, I walk in you. This night I lose myself before me. Doors I push past, I open, books drop, I part them, I come home. Odysseus, beneath the failing ozone, I part them. Moses, staff in hand, at the water, the ceiling, scattering paint chips to the corners. Somewhere in the wide room, a piano overturned, I turn. My body follows, blackbirds scatter, a gunshot, my foot a ram, like Grendel at the barracks, the air rips my ears, I step through the flung open doorway to the street, exit, theater, fealty to a tattered flag in steam above the marquee. And then, once again, a few sections later in this long poem, In the Gun Cabinet. And here now, from my window in the gun cabinet, the trees, movements and hues of blurred shifting greens in each pixelate square of the window screen. And I, too heavy to sit forward, unlock, lift the glass, each leaf in a barrel roll, three or four on one axis, each twig and branch, 30, 40, all shimmering, synthesizing, and in flight, and the major branches swinging back and forth laterally, as if on ecstasy, on the wind, brushing, and me in the chair like a discharged gun, empty space, window pane, small space, then screen, the gun cabinet, hissing in the background, you heavy sop, you late, you overdue can of beans, as the leaves fan, frantic, spectral, past the screen, back arched, a girl, seeming own me through the telly, Greek far off as I am, as she is looking back, all interspace, breath, removal, apotheosis of my culture, dear bomb, dear discovery of the gaze as determinant of place, dear definitive state, and here at my window, from the top of my window, the trees wave like rescue signals, merging in the gun cabinet, branches hurling upward, wrist deep in the glare, a single leaf lifting itself, a finger, my finger, curls upward into the space above, and today a white balloon lifts itself all tremolo to the thinned out blue above the gun cabinet. So this next piece is one of three quote-unquote translations of Catullus in this book. So we were kind of talking for a second about, I guess, like thematic threads running through the book or sort of unifying the poems in some way. And, you know, initially I had thought this would be a larger project, but I started translating different poems of Catullus, despite the fact that I don't know Latin. I can't really translate it myself. There are all these tools available to us now, like Google Translate and, you know, a wealth of English translations of Catullus poems. So my process is kind of like triangulating from those different translations and from Google Translate, and then sort of, I guess, bastardizing the poems to sort of fit the themes that I wanted them to. And this was the second of three, I think, successful poems that came out of that process. In some ways, this one, I don't know, in some ways this one is the best. I think other people like it the most, even though I think the last one, which I'm going to read in a second, kind of fulfilled what I wanted out of this like mini project. But initially this Catullus poem is, about something much different than what it is in my book. So this is called Song Little Myth, Catullus 65. That unremitting siphon, grief, tears me from my desk. Exhausted mind, dead tree, no apple at my lips. Friend, I try, my every thought, the water's tongue, his white foot. Know this, beauty concealed, our loved ones pulled from view. The shore of a state carves the dirt of a city it felled by trickery. In war, my line erased. Brother, I loved you more than the eye I bear toward an end that keeps you from it. That love, a constant garment, absence wears in the outline of a voice. I sing into the suck of it, and the swallow, thrumming, sings with me in the shadow of a branch in the voice of the child she fed, her own, to her husband. That's what I mean by silence, the female nightingale mute. So she makes the swallow sing the crime, her man, his hand, my mouth. Agony aside, friend, here are the poems you asked for. Once a girl was promised love by a boy who meant to keep it. The promise took the form of an apple, the boy the form of dirt. When he left the war, she stayed, the apple in her lap, until she stood in a gust of wind and it ran the crease of her dress. She looked down, tall grass. I suppose she never found it. I imagine her plump cheeks drained of blush, but for the gathering dark. And my face. I keep my word. Here are the poems you asked for. All right. And this last one is the third and final Catullus translation that I wrote. And I, you know, when I was done with this one, like I was saying, I thought, oh, I was going to maybe do a whole manuscript of these. But when I finished this one, I felt very distinctly that I had like found a voice that I was like looking for. And then there was no need to like take this project any further. So this one is called, If Nothing Else, Pleasure, Catullus 76. And Catullus 76 is really about this sort of like forlorn love with Claudia. But as you'll see, this is not about that at all. If nothing else, pleasure. Just knowing one's own borders. That even though others die because of my hands' extensions, it is not by my hands themselves. Now, if one believes in a private kindness and has not broken fraternity or bone, nor through any deal with awe deceived a neighbor by hand or spectacle, does not, if nothing else, joy remain? Let it continue through my life. And if no one really hears through the news of the day, tinged in green in every eye nooseward, if my tongue simply gestures and it heralds a commons, what stone should be cast and at whom? Good intentions fade. That's a crisis. Don't take it as an end. Wade through it. You know it's hard to cast off love, to lead yourself back to pleasure. Find a way. Carry its open corpse like a purse up the steps to the temple and drop it. Laugh in the face of the guard and spit on the gold-plated feet of the statue. Look in its stone eye. Say what it knows. It was fashioned a likeness to hear. I'm here to wash your feet for a price. Look at me, Lord, what grace. What wretch ever spared, what dog, what girl, and me. I am clean. Touch my white skin, my throat, its veins. I think of nothing else. A voice I never asked to speak in booms in my bluest cavity. One thing, reprieve, pleasure, please. I know what it is happening.
Thank you so much, Mike Lala. That is a selection of poetry from Exit Theater from the Center for Literary Publishing, winner of this year's Colorado Prize for Poetry. Now, Mike, I of course, as sort of the podcast producer, editor, am able to sort of sample at will. And of course, I've left out a great deal of your collection, especially a great deal of your collection, which features hybrid genres, multiple formats, you know, interview formats, sort of dramaturgical formats. So it's a very sort of porous collection when it comes to its formal life. And I'm getting the sense, just from the way that you talk about some of these poems, that they are porous in other ways as well. So they invite other presences, other intertexts, other voices, in a very sort of dynamic and robust way. And I wonder if you could maybe talk about that impulse, you know, that impulse to sort of open the poem to a host, or to open the book to multiple modes?
Yeah, I mean, as exit theater sort of began to take shape, I was saying I had written maybe like 2/3 of the poems in the book, and then sort of started realizing like what I needed to sort of make it into a book and the direction I needed to write in. I think I started realizing that the book in a lot of ways needed to deal with elegy and with, you know, particularly with the current sort of these open-ended post-Cold War, post 9/11 military conflicts or wars happening in the Middle East, and my relationship to them as an American citizen, as a, you know, a working artist, a writer in a time of war, and as a, as you know, what's called a military brat, so a kid who's parent was in the military. And I think part of what I wanted to do was use research and source material in a way that allowed the poems to be a kind of records of different events that were reported in certain ways, but you know, and that reporting was believable or unbelievable to me in various degrees. I wanted to use pieces of art, pieces of language from other works, or, you know, like one example is language on Cy Twombly canvases that came from a number of other sources, from old epic poets and different things, to sort of interrupt the poems and my thinking, or, you know, my position as a speaker or I in a poem, in order to trouble that or interject with the voice of others, which seemed really important if I was going to consider these topics from my position, as I was saying previously. So, you know, the poems that are more like plays, those are like attempts at like using quotes from other people and sort of staging this like previously existing language, previously existing material about real events in order to relate those events or talk about, you know, what I see to be behind them. And then there are all these voices that are supposed to come into the poems, or for example, like that last poem really isn't in my voice. It's another voice. Mm. And I wanted a chance to try to let the possibility for voices of, whether it's the dead or of people who facilitated these sort of international sort of acts of terror, to have a place in a book that dealt with those events.
You know, your description of contemporary warfare as open-ended, I think, is totally apt, and really interesting to consider in light of those two sort of like watershed events that you were talking about earlier. You know, the Cold War and sort of post-Cold War, post 9/11, that sort of thing. It seems that at least to my sense, it's almost as if we are living in a situation, in a historical moment, where the nature of what is meant by this word event is sort of troubled, shifting. Like it's difficult, it's more and more difficult to say, you know, this is a war. and that war is an event, or this is an occurrence, this is something that happened. You know, that last line in If Nothing Else Pleasure, I know what it is happening, seems to speak to a larger concern that these poems have, and that is how we in a contemporary situation relate to time and relate to contemporary events and relate to history. And it seems that there's a real blurring here that's happening, maybe as an extension of, you know, how you were describing like contemporary warfare as something that is open-ended, where the actors aren't defined fully and where things seem to go on interminably. And so that feels really, really apt to me.
Thanks. I mean, I think even more specific than our, you know, whatever, our relationship to a particular event, you know, our relationship to what war is. I mean, in a situation or a time in which, like, you know, off and on we're bombing, you know, we're not bombing the governments of seven different countries or government structures of seven different countries, but we're bombing people in seven different countries. Mm-hmm. But the things doing the bombing are often remotely controlled, and the, you know, even though theoretically our constitution dictates that Congress is supposed to vote for a war, they sort of sidestepped that duty to just sort of authorize military force without actually declaring a war. So there are all these like sort of, I don't know, it feels to me like this is like, you know, if you ask the average American citizen or just any person on the street, you know, how many countries are we bombing right now, like, or how many countries have we bombed in the last year? I don't know if they would, you know, they would probably say like one or two, mm-hmm. maybe, you know, they think of Iraq or Afghanistan, or maybe they would know that we occasionally take, you know, we intervene in Pakistan or something like that. But, it seems like, you know, a lot of this information isn't very present in daily life. And, you know, I think a lot of people don't necessarily care about it that much. And poetry is probably not the most galvanizing or effective way of documenting it. But at the same time, one of the things I learned while I was writing this book is the articles that I had read that were written about these events and that I had used as research for the poems, eventually they disappear. There are so many of these articles that I went back to go find and they were just gone. So if you don't have that day's issue of the Washington Post, you're not going to find it. It's not on the website anymore. It's only in print in an archive. And that is like an odd, you know, it's like an odd form of amnesia. And I don't know, you know, maybe it's deliberate, maybe it's not, that it is no longer on the website, but it just seems like there's already no constitutional limit on our military actions in other countries that we have not declared war against and have not attacked us. There's almost no oversight of the way that the executive branch is conducting these wars, and there's almost, you know, there's like a decreased level of press coverage of them. There's very little interest among average people. And so whether it's useful or not right now, it seems important to, I don't know, to me at least, from my position, as I was saying earlier, to sort of write into that and try to at least document some of these things in a way that attempts to draw connections between them.
You know, you were talking earlier about position and how inviting maybe a multitude or a host of voices or genres or textual strategies into this book is a way of maybe negotiating the difficulty of writing from, a singular American Western sort of position. And so, like, I really appreciated the ways you were describing, you know, those maybe prosodic choices or poetic choices as ways of negotiating that. And it's and you were also just mentioned how contemporary people or the contemporary subject maybe negotiates their relationship to particular events in maybe new or different ways as compared to prior times in history. And I just think that that really bears out in the book in terms of like trying to establish relationships, right? It seems that this book is interested in maybe blurring the lines between I and you, or self and other, or citizen of one country and citizen of another country. There's this kind of leakiness that seems to happen here, almost as a way of kind of hijacking the leakiness of the event that you were just speaking to, you know, like these articles sort of dissipating into the ether, you know, the event sort of like spreading out in sort of an open-ended, interminable, leaky sort of way. And that somehow maybe there's something to be gained from a kind of blurring that maybe happens across boundaries, right? And that again seems really spoken to in beautiful ways if nothing else, pleasure, right? In that first line, if nothing else, pleasure, just knowing one's own borders. I don't know, that's sort of my response there to the question of, you know, relationship, which feels to me at the forefront of this collection.
Yeah, I think that's a really astute, reading of the book. And I think that poem in particular is, I think of it as being spoken from a vantage point of someone who is resisting that, as you say, leakiness or blurring, or trying to preserve their subjective position, or their particular subjective position, and also preserve their comfort in it, even if they are perhaps an actor or part of a series of actors that are perpetuating discomfort and death somewhere else. It just seems to me like, this is the topic of this particular topic of war, and what's currently happening in the world. I think there are a lot of really good political poets out there, but very few of them deal with this topic in particular. And there are obviously other very worthy topics that have political, social implications, but this is one that I'm particularly adept at speaking at, I would say, or speaking to, I think, because of where I come from. And it's indicative of a larger cultural and national sort of, I guess, disgrace. that the only really war poetry that we have comes from soldiers who actually fought in the wars. And that's not to say that those people shouldn't write poems about their experiences. But I think the fact that there aren't a lot of sort of civilian poets, if you will, writing about these things sort of is indicative of the fact that it's really easy for us to say, well, not in my backyard, not people I know, not people who live like me, not people who share my religion or, you know, whatever definition of cultural attitudes that you have for yourself. I didn't vote for that person, or I didn't support that war when it was being debated or whatever. So, you know, it's terrible that it's happening, but I don't feel the necessity of learning about it or knowing, you know, what inevitably I contribute to. And, you know, when when the war in Iraq has resulted in a million deaths, I just sort of bristle at that attitude. And I think that poetry has a long history of sort of record-keeping, antagonizing power, and taking a position, whether explicitly or implicitly, of, you know, naming people or presenting real facts and evidence for things that we sort of have, I think, let go of in a lot of American poetry or contemporary American poetry. So, yeah, that became sort of a flashpoint for how I wanted to work and how I wanted to address these topics.
I love what you were saying about sort of this inability to know what it is we contribute to as actors in either local context or more global context. Again, that seems maybe like a sort of new facet to a kind of modern experience, which it seems, at least by my reading, that this book is really kind of grappling with maybe dissonances between sort of modernity, postmodernity, and pastness, or this sort of the historical. So, on the back of the book, I think someone blurbed the phrase like shared culpability, and that seems fully relevant to what you were talking about in terms of what a civilian poetry might look like in a wartime situation. Certainly in a wartime situation where like the very definition of what it means to be at war seems troubled, right? Last question. I had the chance to talk to the copy editor of your book before I Skype, Katie, with you.
Yeah.
Katie Young. Yeah. And I asked her if she had any sort of questions for you, maybe burning on the top of her brain. And she mentioned she'd like to know maybe more about the role of family in this collection, or like sort of personal familial relationships. She mentioned that a figure of a brother shows up often. And I'm just wondering if maybe you could speak to that for a moment, the role that maybe you see family and family relationships playing in a book that is otherwise, you know, very concerned with sort of global and that which is outside, sort of the domestic.
Sure. Well, in Exit Theater in particular, I mean, I think I mentioned previously that I come from like a military family, as we say, and I do have two brothers. I don't think that is mentioned really that particularly or that specifically in the book. There are a number of times where siblings are mentioned, and, you know, a mother and a father. And so in some ways, sometimes those things are like kind of, you know, based on, you know, I think there's a moment when a photo is taken or something, and that's kind of true to real life. But particularly with respect to siblings and or a brother. So going back to Catullus, the one poem that I didn't read is a quote-unquote translation of Catullus 101, which is an elegy for Catullus's brother who died in the Troad in a military conflict. And so that sort of opens the book, and going back to what we were saying about letting the voices of others in and that sort of thing, that poem sort of establishes the idea of like speaking to someone who's dead or to the dead and considering why they're dead. And considering like the historical or social political context in which they are dead. And then at other points in the gun cabinet, for example, there are addresses made to a brother or a sister the speaker doesn't know. And I found the idea of, you know, it's problematic, but the idea of family, there's sort of a, you know, an immediate nuclear family, which is, you know, mentioned in the book in some ways. And that's, you know, that's useful to talk about why I'm interested in these topics in particular. And it's just useful as like an emotional sort of subject or, you know, kind of sounding point in which to make certain statements. But it's also useful to think of like a larger idea of what a family is, or the sort of like, you know, familial or family-esque kind of bonds that tie different people together through different situations or being on different sides of different events. So there are moments where like family in these poems isn't really about, you know, my brother, my sister, my mom, my dad, my grandpa, my grandma, my uncle or aunt, whatever it is, but really about like, this is like a person with whom I share this, you know, there's like a partition between this person and me, and that partition is an event that is like uncrossable or untranslatable, but we both have a relation to it from different sides. And so, you know, for example, there are people with whom I will never be able to speak, or never be able to get their perspective on these events that we were talking about, these wars, because they're dead. And so how can I allow my poem or poems to sort of open a space wherein, even though I can't speak to that person, I attempt to, or I attempt to sort of cross that untranslatable partition. And that in a way makes, or that partition or that event, that in a way makes them my other half or something like that. So, you know, in a way, family in the book is sort of, you know, pretty openly defined, but there's, it's something more than just a blood bond.
Right. That's beautifully stated. Thank you. And thank you for talking with me more generally. I had, you know, a very, very instructive conversation. So thanks, Mike.
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you, Kyle.
You've been listening to the Colorado Review podcast, which can be found at iTunes and at the Colorado Review website, coloradoreview.colostate.edu. Also online, you can find selections from recent and archived issues of the journal, blog posts, reviews, and much more. This podcast is made possible by Colorado State University and the Center for Literary Publishing. Thanks for listening.